From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made in Detroit, a city that saw a steady decline in the wake of job losses over several decades. Then Mayor Dave Bing had an idea to help spark new life into Detroit. He wanted to shrink the actual boundaries of the city and focus revitalization efforts within a new city center. Now, rather quickly, the idea was shot down by city government and the council. But Bing's proposal has created ripple effects that last to this day. It impacts how developers think about what Detroit is and what parts are worthy of job creation efforts. The outer ring is generally left out, and in the Atlantic Monthly, focusing on P.E. Moskowitz's book, How to Kill a City, the conclusion is that this is another form of gentrification. But what if that development had come to all of Detroit, not just a glorified section downtown? What happens when property values rise and more people want to move in? Gentrification generally refers to a circumstance when longtime or original neighborhood residents move out of an area because of rising rents, often higher taxes. They can't afford mortgages. When development happens, not everyone can afford to enjoy it. So what can be done about this? Can we see development without displacement? That's kind of the new buzz phrase in development. This hour, we want to discuss what gentrification is and ideas to either deal or prevent it in general. So let's talk about that this hour. Our guests include Calvin Eaton, founder and executive director of 540 West Main Communiversity. Welcome back. Nice to have you.
Hi, Evan. How are you?
Very good. Also with us is Joe DiFiore, who's president of City Roots Community Land Trust and board member with the Beechwood Neighborhood Coalition. Joe, welcome back. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
And Miriam Zinter is a mortgage officer at the Community Preservation Corporation. Welcome back to you as well.
Thanks so much, Evan.
There is an event coming up on Saturday, March 30th. That is doing the math. Is that two Saturdays? That's two Saturdays from now, Calvin.
It's coming up.
Okay, yeah. It's 9 days from now. It's the Spring 2019 Gentrification Conference at 540 West Main. What do you want to focus on there? Who is this aimed at?
It's aimed to the community. Everyone at the community will be here downtown at the MCC downtown campus on the third floor. And the conference is for community members, stakeholders, developers, activists, everyone who really has a stake in the city of Rochester and development and making sure that all of our neighborhoods, including downtown and beyond, are accessible for all. And this spring's theme, is talking about development without displacement, action and activism. So really helping the community understand what groups are, what things are happening group wise, what they can do to make sure that policy, et cetera, makes housing, jobs accessible. All of these things are interrelated and intersectional. So that's really what we want to make clear here at the conference this spring.
All right, so you can still register. And so here's the information. It's 540-540-gentrificationrock.org online. If you want to register, they ask $10 a person, but I know Calvin has said no community member is going to be turned away. If you
no
want to
one's turned away there. We have quite a few sponsors, including the Community Preservation Corporation, home leasing, et cetera. So everyone can come and, no one will be turned away.
Okay. And so, again, it's 9 days away. There's also a keynote address from the author I mentioned at the outset. That's P.E. Moskowitz. And they wrote a book called How to Kill a City, Gentrification, Inequality, and the Fight for the Neighborhood. And Moskowitz's book takes us to New Orleans, Detroit, a lot of different cities where gentrification has happened in different ways. And what are you looking forward to most with P.E. Moskowitz?
Well, I think P.E. will give a broad overview of gentrification across the country. Of course, the cities that are featured in their book are much larger than Rochester and in very different ways, very different than Rochester. But gentrification still does happen in Rochester. It doesn't look the same way that it looks in New Orleans or New York City or the West Coast. But because of the dynamics and demographic of Rochester, we know that we still have a very much a segregated community. We see that between city and suburban. We see that with our school district. And the great thing about PE's book is that it really makes the connection between all of these factors: history, poverty, jobs. All of it is interrelated. It's interrelated with racism, governmental policies, systemic policies that have really disparaged marginalized identities over history to create this concept of gentrification. And part of the groups that we represent here at the panel today, how do we disrupt that? How do we educate the community to know what's happening on the policy level and get developers to rethink how they're developing. Why is a specific neighborhood like Beechwood a hot neighborhood right now? Why has it been disinvested and needing to be reinvested? And then who's at the table there? And who is that new investment for? You need to really understand history to understand how to not allow it to happen again.
So I think Beechwood is just one example that we'll talk specifically about. But I want to ask all three of our guests an important point that I know they want to weigh in on. Sometimes when we talk about gentrification, there gets to be a stereotype that, well, if that's what you're worried about, then you are anti-development. Calvin said before the hour even began, this is not about being anti-development at all, but let's hit that point. Go ahead.
Well, no, we're not anti-development at all. We want this development without displacement. So we want to make sure that rents are affordable, and we want to make sure that when we talk about affordability, what does that mean? So for Rochester, we talk a lot about AMI and how much of a person's income is going towards their rent. We talk about individuals who have rented a property like the Cadillac Hotel, for instance, that was used for many years by government agencies, et cetera, for individuals that were on the fringes of society. Many of them paid rent faithfully for many years, 15, 20 years. Then they're forced to move out, and they have no stakeholder in the property. They had no say as to not only that to let it get to the place where it was needing to be rehabbed, deplorable conditions. We saw the piece that Dave Andriotta did about that. And then now it's going to be, at least as far as we know, high-end development, and those people have been, who knows where they are, and they have no say in that. That's not fair to people, even if they don't own a property. If we're saying that housing is a human right, then is it really a human right, and does the policies reflect that?
Okay. Miriam, how do you view defining sort of development without displacement? Because it is a buzz phrase right now, and it's a really nice idea. How often do you actually see it happening in practice?
It can happen quite a bit. It's thoughtful development. It's looking at a community. It's meeting with people who live in the neighborhoods and talking with them about their vision for their community. A lot of the neighborhoods where CPC does development have been neighborhoods where capital was denied systematically for generations. And when you pull capital out of a community, you take away people's ability to build wealth, you take away people's ability to shop locally. There's a whole system of things that break down when communities are denied capital. So when we look at development at CPC, we look at what is it that the community wants and what can we do to help. And part of it is not just being inclusive of people of all incomes, it's also all abilities. For example, you know, how accessible are the apartment buildings? How accessible are the buildings in the community? And what can we do to provide capital so that this community can truly thrive through diversity of incomes, through diversity of races, religions, of all kinds of people that can live in a community and benefit together.
By the way, just as an aside, I was just passed a note that of something I was not aware of. You're part of the WXXI Community Advisory Board now, is that right?
That is correct.
All right, so full disclosure, I may have to be even more difficult on you this hour. I suspect
Come
it will
at
not
me, bro.
Be a problem. Okay, I suspect it will not be a problem. I did not know that, though, so anyway, we always try to be, in a sense, full disclosure. And Miriam's been on the program numerous times in the past. Okay, Joe, on the subject of development without displacement, I think Beechwood, you know, Calvin brought up Beechwood. And when we look at around different parts of Rochester, I'm curious to know how you feel like this question is either being met or it is being ignored, development without displacement.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so speaking of Beechwood in particular, yeah, as a board member, That's definitely, it's actually specifically laid out in our platform for something that we're working towards, development without displacement. We want to welcome development. We recognize that we need the investment in the neighborhood, but it has to be for the people that live here now, the people that have seen disinvestment for decades. And also, we recognize that that won't just happen through good intentions, but that we have to have actual specific policies and actual specific strategy as to how that's going to happen before we get to the point where we realize, oh, the property values have gotten too expensive for our neighbors to afford the rents or to be able to live here. So that's where we're working so closely with City Roots Community Land Trust, is to look for ways to say, how can we as a community secure land holdings so that we can dictate as a community what the property value will be for these specific properties, for this commercial storefront, for this specific land use.
Yeah, and so, you know, Joe, there was one idea that was brought up in a phone call to this program probably a couple of years ago now as we talked about gentrification that has stayed in my mind, because I want to talk a little bit about strategies in saying, hey, if we're successful and development is happening, what is the kind of development that is not going to push people out? One of the things that happens is, as property values rise, there's concern about, can we afford to pay taxes or do rents rise? And one of the proposals that was sort of brought up in a phone call in this program was, you know, there can be either legislation on city level or policy that says your taxes or your value can't go up more than X percentage, or if your property value goes up more than X percentage, and it's, you know, you can sort of pick different targets, that your taxes are capped at that point for X amount of years, whether it's 5 years, 10 years, or indefinitely. That's one idea. To me, that was a very direct way to say, we're never going to see enough development happen where all of a sudden you've been here for a long time and now you can't afford your place just because things have turned. Mm-hmm. We're going to make sure that you're not forced out that way. That was an idea. What are some of the other ideas that kind of come out? And yeah, do you I like that? Does that make sense?
Oh, no. Yeah, I think that's a piece of the puzzle for sure. I think that it's only one piece of the puzzle. So it doesn't necessarily address the rents that people pay, right? If it's a hot area and a private landlord knows they can get for their apartment, you know, $1,200 and their current tenant's paying $800, they're very likely going to raise it up. So that's where things like the tenants union's been trying to organize around some other aspects of development without displacement. And they've got a whole platform around that, around just cause eviction and rent control and some other things that, you know, they could speak better to than myself. But there's other things like the Plex neighborhood, for instance, that gentrification is another hot button issue for them. Development without displacement there. They're trying to organize a community benefits agreement so that when a developer comes in, if they want to build their for-profit market rate apartments, they should do something for the community, for the residents that are there. So that could be in the form of building some affordable units. It could be in the form of putting some money up for a community park. It could be, you know, community gathering space, etc. But the community kind of dictates through a negotiation, this is our community benefit agreement. And there's a plethora of other tools that could be going. But for me, the big one that we're focused on, obviously, is the community land trust aspect, because if you don't control the land in your community, you're left out of the conversation from the get-go, right? People come to the neighbor association and any neighbor association across the city all the time as kind of a nod to you. Like, okay, we want to do something in your neighborhood. We need a variance for it. Can we get your blessing? And the city likes to see that. The Zoning Board of Appeals likes to see that. But it's not a requirement. It's not something that it's make or break the deal. At the end of the day, if it's a private holding, if they can jump through the hoops, they get to do whatever they want. Versus saying, you know, this is community-controlled storefront. We're not looking to put in the most profitable business. We're looking to put in a business that reflects the needs of the community, that reflects the culture of the community. And that's a conversation that's left out, or an aspect that's left out of the conversation a lot of times when we're talking about development without displacement. It's not just about economic displacement, but it can also be about cultural displacement. So there's a certain culture to Parcells Avenue, where I live, right? Maybe that's a culture where it's different than where I grew up, where you might always want to have your cookouts in the suburbs, where I grew up, in the backyard. And on Parcells Avenue, it might be more commonplace to have your cookout in the front yard, right? You can start to see certain tensions there when there's different kinds of music than the new people moving in are used to, when there's different kinds of behavior. And, you know, that's when you start getting the police called or complaints to the neighborhood association, neighborhood service center, and people start to feel a little cultural discomfort around a place where they used to think, well, this is what we've always done here. We've always had our family members, extended family, friends come over and party in the front yard, and it was always acceptable until now. And other people might have a different idea around that. So point being, when you actually control the aspect, the land aspect, you really dictate where the conversation goes and how the development goes. Otherwise, you're just at the mercy of the private developers to do the right thing which they have a very strong motive not to do, which is the accumulation of wealth. That's usually their main motivation, right?
Where are parts of Rochester where, when you think gentrification that's happened, what stands out first, Calvin?
What stands out first in terms of the words happened?
Yeah, different sections, different neighborhoods. And
I mean, Cornhill.
Cornhill.
For sure. I mean, it looks very different than it did historically. We see Plex as huge.
Okay.
You know, the Plymouth Avenue, South Plymouth Avenue, the bridge, near the bridge, and the river there, for sure.
South Wedge?
Not the, well, 4th Street Bridge or that area.
Okay.
Just South Wedge, for sure.
Okay.
Yeah, it's another place.
Yeah. Add in Market View Heights, right around the market area. I mean, you look at Railroad Street and what it looked like 20 years ago, it's, I mean, nobody was hanging out on Railroad Street of the same demographic that there's now. Now it's all high-end restaurants, right? It was artists that came in first. It's the classic kind of gentrification scenario. The artists came in, kind of made it hip a little bit. Then they got pushed out. Then they moved into high-end restaurants. They're investing in the public market. It's all great, but it's not necessarily for the people of Market View Heights. Like, if you ask them if they're going to, well, I don't want to get into the specific restaurants that are there and badmouth them because there's nothing wrong with the restaurants, but they're not exactly catering to the neighborhood.
Okay.
And that's important because I want listeners to understand that we're not saying that it's not good that Railroad Street now is a vibrant, happening sort of neighborhood. But we do want to acknowledge that there were organizations, there businesses, artists there who really helped make the neighborhood a place where developers said, people want to be here. People want to thrive here. And there were other businesses there that didn't look like the businesses that are there now that once the development happened, they either were told, well, the rent's higher now, so you've had a business here. It could be 540 West Main one day where we hopefully are there for a while. Rents increase because of the surrounding neighborhood. And then, well, either you pay the triple rent or, you know, we really don't really like your business. There's nothing wrong with it, but that's not really what we want here. So then you're slowly, like, in a way that's not really overt, sort of pushed away, pushed out more or less. And then you have to put your business somewhere else, and it's a different culture.
And many times along sort of with racial undercurrent.
Sometimes, or other undercurrents, and maybe there's a community, maybe there's an LGBTQ community that people who don't want that there, and so they'll find ways to sort of nuance around it, and we really don't want those people here. They won't say that, and so we just want to acknowledge that this is what happens. It's happened in our communities, and we would be being naive if we didn't recognize and acknowledge that.
It was on this program that a developer, Drew Costanza, was having a conversation with us. And I want to play a clip because he was talking about Railroad Street and that area. Here's what he had to say, and then you're going to hear Larry Francer from the Landmark Society as well. Listen.
You look at what's happened to that neighborhood, Railroad Street specifically, in the last 10, 15 years, stemming primarily from the upgrades to the public market. And it's just dramatic. I mean, my kids go to beg my wife to take her down, drive from Mendon to go to the public market on Saturday. You've seen not only all of Railroad Street become renovated and go to try find an empty building on Railroad Street, good luck, but the really cool, sexy, kind of exciting part is the gentrification that's been kicked off by Market View Heights and the renovation of Railroad Street. You're seeing all those single and two-family houses for blocks in every direction, all getting renovated, fixed up, and it's happening naturally. Nobody's doing it.
We got to spend a whole other hour on how you use the word gentrification. Did you use it as a positive?
A positive.
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
It's not the G word. Displacement is the D word.
Okay, so what Larry's trying to say, and I think Larry's not on this program. He's a really kind person. I think what he's trying to at least indicate there is, he was trying to sort of massage that and say, hey, what it means is maybe without displacement. But do you see it without displacement at Railroad Street?
Well, I would just ask, I guess, listeners to imagine what that development would have looked like if those buildings had been owned by the community, as in the residents of that neighborhood. And I don't think that we would see anything like the development what we have. I think we could get to the same level. Like, if we had the same amount of money and gave it to the community to say, develop this Railroad Street, we would have very different businesses there. And that's, I think, at the heart of what we're talking about when we talk about development without displacement, right?
Well,
go ahead.
Well, I want to jump in, too, just because it's, for me, listening to that comment, it talks about, so we can't take away race, class, privilege, et cetera, in this conversation where we're, so the dictionary definition of gentrification is the process of renovating and improving a house or district so that it conforms to middle class taste. So that's what I hear when I hear Drew talking about where my kids want to come here now. There are always children and people and families that live near Railroad Street in those bordering neighborhoods. I grew up going to people's friends. There's a park there. And did anyone ask those neighbors what they wanted to see on Railroad Street? Did anyone care about why was it cared about when the middle class taste wanted to sort of make it the hip and happening neighborhood, but not before that? So these are the nuances that we educate about at 540 West Main and at the conference, where it's whose taste is this for? Can the neighboring community next to Railroad Street afford some of those restaurants? I'm not sure. I don't want to make judgments, but based on what we know about that area code and the poverty rate in that neighborhood, perhaps not. And so who's at the table? Who was at the table? And Joel is speaking a lot about if the community owns the land, when developers or whomever is coming and saying, well, we want to now help you improve this neighborhood, we have a say in what's going there.
I think you touched on something that's very crucial, Calvin.
Yeah.
Is the capital staying within the community?
Right.
So, you know, are the people who own the businesses, who own the buildings, who are getting money in that neighborhood, keeping it in the neighborhood? Are the people who live in the neighborhood benefiting through employment? Mm-hmm. Are they benefiting through increased equity in their properties? Or were the original residents, did they have to leave? Mm-hmm. I don't know. It's something that I think would be important to look at when neighborhoods turn. You know, how many of the original residents were able to remain? How many people benefit from the infusion of capital in the community? Is this something that the community had a say in? Or was this a decision that was made from people that live outside the community that saw an opportunity to maximize their own profit without benefiting the people that live there?
And I could, if I could, Miriam, it sounds to me like what I'm hearing from Joe is it's important to have these conversations and to educate, but if you don't organize, if you don't have, for example, a land trust, if you don't have sort of a collective effort, you're going to run up against sort of the forces of money, which often win out when it comes to development decisions. Is that a fair sort of summation,
yeah,
at least?
And we see it time and time again, where even when people organize, if you organize against a development that you think doesn't fit your neighborhood, but it fits the zoning code, and they own the property, and they have the resources to do it, they're going to do it. There's no stopping it. So it's more about kind of beating them at their own game or joining in and saying, okay, let's join together as a community, let's get organized, and not just try to stop development, but to become part of the development, the kind of development that we want to see.
Okay.
In the meantime, advocating for policies that affect that larger development scope, because, you know, the community is not going to be able to develop everything, but we want, when developers do come in, we want it to happen on the terms of the community.
So talking about organizing and resources, we know that in impoverished neighborhoods, organizing looks very different. People have, you know, there's... Mm-hmm. They were working 2 and 3 jobs to make ends meet. They can't always go to a city council meeting the same way that a household in Pittsburgh, say, can. And so when we talk about organizing, it's not that neighbors don't care in areas like the Susan B. District or Beechwood, but it's that there's a lot on their plate. The people have homes, they have housing, they have food. Those basic necessities aren't being met. And so usually in urban centers where poverty is highly concentrated, developers are able to sort of bulldoze through and sort of get their way, whereas in suburban areas where there's more money in those neighborhoods, they can push back. And we see that in neighborhoods like North Winton Village, where they have the resources, the manpower, the energy to push back against the development and to have it fit their needs in ways that really highly concentrated poverty neighborhoods do not have that same opportunity. So we can't take that out of the equation as well.
Okay, I want to spend a lot of the rest of the hour on feedback from our listeners, because they've got questions and comments for our guests. Adam writes to us and says, What I think I'm hearing from your guests is there shouldn't be nice restaurants on Railroad Street because they're too expensive for the people who live there. Is it just true that in neighborhoods with more poverty, we shouldn't want to have development include nice restaurants? That's from Adam.
Well, I think we already answered that. We said that there's nothing wrong with neighborhoods, nice restaurants, and we want to see thriving communities, but we also want equity to stay in those neighborhoods. We want the people who live there to have a say. We want the restaurants and the resources that are part of that neighborhood to benefit the people who live in that community and who have always lived there, as opposed to a development really being built for an outside middle class to come in, use resources, perhaps not employ anyone who lives in that neighborhood. So that development really does not benefit anyone who's lived in that neighborhood. It only benefits other people who come in, use the resources, and then leave. That's what we don't want to see.
And can I ask you a specific question about about Arnett and about Beechwood? You see New City Cafe, a coffee shop. Now, it's a very nice coffee shop, and I know a lot of people who like going there who don't live in that area. But I also, at least early on, had heard that they were going to try to at least kind of cut coffee prices for people who lived in the neighborhood or at least offer more affordable coffee, I would say affordable coffee based on different means. Do you see that as an example of the kind of development that, hey, you may be attracting people who don't live in Beechwood, but you're also saying we care about Beechwood?
Yeah, and I don't want to speak for 441 Ministries, but I work with them a lot, and the Land Trust meets in their space. Actually, our general meeting's tonight at 441 Ministries, which is the parent organization of New City Cafe. And they try to be very cognizant of gentrification and making sure that they are integrated into the neighborhood and they employ people from the neighborhood, and they specifically look to train youth from the neighborhood in job skills training. And so they're very cognizant of it, and also I think aware of their effect, their potential negatives of the effect of having a coffee shop, which is kind of like the flagship or poster child often people think of when they think of gentrification. So they're trying to do it the right way, and I think that they've been figuring it out. They do the dollar coffee now. I mean, Kelvin, you co-work there a lot.
I'm biased for New City. I mean, I love New City, and I'm there several times a week. And I can say that they have been very purposeful and intentional on making sure that they have resources that benefit the neighborhood. So they were able to bring Food Link in. They were able to support the streets makeover, where they're slowing down traffic and really engaging with the families. They have a kids club every weekend. So it's really, it is a coffee place, but it's such a community hub, and it's accessible to everyone. We see all income levels in New City working. No one's made to feel like, at least in my perspective, no one's made to feel like you don't belong here. You can sit there all day and work, whether you have a laptop or not, and use the Wi-Fi, use the bathroom, use the phone, get something printed. So it really has become a community center. And because they've been intentional on really making sure that they're reaching out to the neighbors and to meet their needs, having fruits and vegetables there through a grant, et cetera, I think that you see that it can be done. You can have a thriving workforce development site, for more or less, is what New City is, but also it'd be a coffee shop as well.
All right, let me grab some phone calls. Andrew in Irondequoit next. Go ahead, Andrew.
Have you guys ever actually pulled off the stuff that you're talking about?
Well, we just mentioned, we talked about New City Cafe, for sure, and
do they actually cut prices for people that are in the neighborhood?
Yes,
they do. They have a dollar. They have a dollar coffee for anyone, for everyone. It's accessible to everyone at New City Cafe. In terms of, I know Miriam can speak a little bit about home leasing and properties, what home leasing has done for taking over a property that was sort of left needing to be rehabbed and making it for those neighbors who've lived there.
There are a number of for-profit developers, like Home Leasing is a for-profit developer, as well as not-for-profit developers that thoughtfully go into communities, have community meetings, speak with the people that live there, and develop very purposeful housing that is affordable to the people in the community, but that also can bring in some market units as well, and they're very successful with that. The properties are beautiful. They're beautifully managed. People feel that they're part of the community. They are part of the community. So if you're speaking about the housing portion, yes, it's done all the time and very successfully here in Rochester. As far as the business portion, I've just been sitting here getting very hungry, listening about delicious restaurants in various parts of the city that I now need to go to. Mm-hmm. But especially New City Cafe.
Yeah,
I've been driving past there on a number of occasions and have wanted to stop in. And now that I know that that they were very thoughtful and worked with the community on their placement.
And employ people from the neighborhood.
And employ people from the neighborhood, I will be very purposeful and thoughtful about patronizing that business.
But Andrew, it sounds like you've got some skepticism here. Go ahead.
A two-tiered system, I hope you guys can pull it off.
Well,
but
Andrew, we want to be clear, this is not us. This is changing how we as a society look at urban planning, look at development in cities all across the country. So we see where on the West Coast, if these conversations are not had, people literally, not just people who are in poverty, but middle and upper middle class people, cannot afford to live on the West Coast.
Oh, I get it.
Because of these issues.
We don't want that kind of rubric, whatever you call it, here in Rochester. You can't buy a house in Seattle or San Francisco or probably Los Angeles, too.
So if we don't have these conversations and start changing the way we look at, we think about cities and accessibility and development and policy,
right,
then we will continue to have what's happened in New Orleans, in New York City, where it's affecting everyone now. And so we have to sort of look at this as a very complex, nuanced issue. Right. And we're also not just on the radio selling this pipe dream.
Yeah.
These are conversations that affect every single person in a community.
Yeah, okay. It just strikes me as odd when you say it is one price for one group of people and another price for another. I mean, as far as like coffee goes. But I know that when Ibero was building houses, a friend of mine's auditor, and he looked at how many houses they built for how many hundreds of thousands of dollars, and he was like, something's wrong here. It's $300,000 per house. So hopefully you don't gum things up with red tape.
Andrew, thank you for the phone call. And the notion of different prices that we talked about, New City Cafe, businesses have the rights to set prices that they want to. And, you know, Calvin and the conference, the Spring Gentrification Conference, they have $10 suggested per person. But you also have decided if
Absolutely.
People don't have the means, you want them to be there.
Well, it's a conversation that it's a very nuanced, because we even think about, you know, Hart's Local Grocers, which we know is closing now, and it's a downtown grocery store, independent. We all really wanted Hart's to succeed, but for some individuals, the price point was just too expensive for the residents that lived in that neighborhood. So if we don't have these conversations on the front end, all of these issues are interrelated. They're not just individual or binary. Then you have situations where you have Hart's Local Grocers, then they last just 5 years or a little less than 5 years. So it's important that we understand that we all have to change the way that we're looking at how we're building our communities and our neighborhoods.
Carrie, Allie, Bonnie on the phone. We're coming to you in just a moment here. Calvin Eaton is the founder and executive director of 540 West Main Community, and they are hosting the Spring 2019 Gentrification Conference. That's actually happening downtown MCC. Where is that?
MCC Downtown, right MCC across downtown the street from WXXI.
Right there.
Yes.
I'm looking at it. So that's what it is. So if you want to register, it's 9 days away. That's two Saturdays. Saturday, March 30th, 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. at the MCC Downtown campus. It's 540gentrificationrock.org. If you want to register, be part of that. And as Calvin mentioned earlier, they'd like to see the whole community there. Miriam Zinter is here, a mortgage officer at the Community Preservation Corporation. Jody Fiore is president of City Roots Community Land Trust and board member with the Beechwood Neighborhood Coalition. Your phone calls after this only break. I'm Evan Dawson. Friday on The Next Connections. Hispanic women are paid 54 cents on the dollar earned by white men. That's according to the Economic Policy Institute. In advance of Equal Pay Day, we discuss the gender pay gap and what's known as the double gap for Latinas. Then in our second hour, an upcoming summit on organics will explore ways to reduce food waste, overcome challenges in recycling organic materials, and more, and we'll preview it for you. Welcome back to Connections. Okay, everyone, our phone lines are lit, which just means if we don't get your calls, we're going to get as many as we can in the next 20 minutes or so. You're probably going to need to be at the Spring 2019 Gentrification Conference. Now, Joe wanted to make an additional point here before we go back to phone calls. Go ahead, Joe.
Yeah, just real quick. For one, New City Cafe's coffee is a dollar for everybody, so there's no price tier. But I did want to talk about the idea of this unlevel playing field a little bit. And just give a real brief history of some policies around unlevel playing field that have been in our country for a long time, specifically redlining, which was the practice of disallowing certain neighborhoods to be approved for mortgages. And that was in conjunction with very, very nice mortgage offerings that were given to people to move out to the suburbs at that time. So it was predominantly white people, almost exclusively white people, that were allowed to move out to the suburbs using these mortgage subsidies that were approved by the federal government, and also government-sanctioned policy to say that people who lived in redline neighborhoods could not receive those mortgage subsidies or mortgages at all, or even loans to fix up their houses. And the people in those redline neighborhoods just so happened to be black people. So this notion that there was this unlevel playing field, or that, you know, that it's maybe not such a good thing. Yeah, it's not such a good thing. But we have this historic precedent that we've set for decades and decades, and really since the inception of this country. And we need to recognize that and come to terms with that. And that's a huge moral segment of what we're trying to get at with this development without displacement, right? It's about equitable development. It's about this moral imperative to right the wrongs of the past and to say, hey, these people were systematically, they saw their neighborhoods disinvested from through very specific intention and policies that were government-driven, private, economically driven. And now as development returns to those neighborhoods, those people deserve to have a say in how that development comes about in their communities. So we've got to think about that when we talk about an unlevel playing field. And it's not just about, hey, we're bringing in these high-end restaurants. What's wrong with high-end restaurants? There's nothing wrong with high-end restaurants. They're great. You know, I enjoy them, whatever. If you can afford them, that's great. But we can't discount the fact that people had their neighborhoods systematically disinvested from and were never allowed to accumulate that wealth that so many others were privy to.
Okay. To kind of close the loop on Andrew's phone call, we're going to quickly rip through some phone calls here. So keep it tight. Al wants to just make one more point after Andrew's call. Go ahead, Al.
Guy, I just wanted to rebut Andrew thinking it's so difficult. If you travel around to tourist places, they regularly have different rates for locals. If you show a local driver's license or tourists, they do it in Hawaii. I know they do it in Florida. So that's not that hard a thing to do, and it's not unprecedented.
Mm-hmm. Al, thank you for the phone call. I appreciate that. Carrie in Victor is next. Carrie, go ahead.
Am I on? Okay, yeah.
You're on.
I just want to thank you so much for having this program, first of all, and hope that you'll follow up with many more because people need to get educated about this. I'm educated. Funny, I heard the other program, and so anyway, I'm slow and you need me to be fast. I think that I was sitting here listening and going, oh man, but what are they going to do? How are they going to do it? And then he talked about like the sliding scale. That is a great idea. It is a normal idea. It's a way to, I'm so excited about that idea. I think that people who don't understand the reparation that should be made to people who are disenfranchised, who are discriminated, had discriminatory practices over many, many years, need to educate themselves. I don't know. I'm just saying, get more in the news. Get this going because this is just wrong. It's just super wrong for people to get pushed out of their space that they have been in and is their homes, their space. And last but not least, doing what you're doing will promote peace and understanding, because we're in real trouble if we don't get to know each other better. Those are my crazy thoughts. Here I wrote them down and I didn't say them very well.
No, Carrie, thank you. You can call anytime. I appreciate
that. And Carrie, in terms of education, this is education that the City Roots Land Trust does, 540 West Main, really every month. Mm-hmm. Next week we have two classes before the conference. So Intro to Gentrification, for people to understand the concept. And then Shane Wiegand, who is a colleague of ours as well, will be doing the history of redlining next week to really help people to understand before next Saturday's conference.
And I'll just say that history of redlining will be specific to Rochester.
Yes, yeah. For sure.
So information online, what's your website, Calvin?
540westmain.org.
540westmain.org if you want to learn more. And Carrie, we will continue to follow up on this, because one of the things that Carrie mentioned from the outset is she is concerned about the history, but also wondering, are there specific ways of addressing this? So when we talk development without displacement, can it happen? I think our guests have tried to offer ideas on not only where it's happening, but also different strategies going forward. So on that note, to kind of build off Carrie's call, What would you like to see happening in different parts? All of our guests mentioned different neighborhoods or parts of Rochester where you see gentrification that concerns you. I'll give you the South Wedge. I'll give you anything else that stands out. What do you want to see start to happen or change there?
Well, a big piece of Rochester is making sure that people have jobs that are living wages. I so much of this, we haven't even talked about poverty in the city of Rochester, and so much of this conversation intersects with poverty and people being able to have a living wage and not working poor. And so, again, if you don't have your basic needs met, then, you know, owning property can be it can be something that seems really inaccessible. And so there are many programs that all across the city to help people with that. We know that we're talking about jobs and what jobs are coming. Education is a big piece. That's a whole another connection show in terms of education and people getting a high school diploma and then having skills that they can actually utilize in our communities, what jobs are coming to the neighborhoods. And so there are many organizations like the Venture Jobs Foundation who are working towards that in terms of housing, tenants union, rental rights, homelessness in Rochester. So the conference will really, all of these complex issues intersect. And so the conference in the afternoon specifically will have different groups, constituencies, breaking out the community into workshops, telling them what can they specifically do.
And Joe mentioned, I think, tenant unions earlier. Mm-hmm. Got a phone call, and we'll kind of build on that point. This is Allie in Rochester on that subject. Go ahead, Allie.
Hey, guys, it's Allie with the Citywide Tenant Union and the Homeless Union. Just a couple of quick thoughts. Something that you guys haven't talked a ton about is the actual displacement of people because of new construction. We've seen that again and again and again in this area, from the Laura Street placement, where we're physically mass evicting an entire building because we want to either tear it down or totally, totally redo it. The cattle being another example, and I have to plug the legislation. Just Cause Eviction is a bill in both the Senate and the Assembly that would prevent this from happening. The other thing I just want to plug out that hopefully you guys can chat through is the home stability support. That is due increase the welfare allowance for people to be able to stay in their homes. So one way to kind of counteract the gentrification and the displacement is if people can't afford to pay their rent because the area is gentrifying, increasing the amount of money that they have to pay their rent will help keep them in their homes. And it helps bring more diversity to the neighborhood instead of changing the feel of the neighborhood like we've seen in a lot of these neighborhoods. You know, you mentioned Railroad Street. We've seen it a lot in the 19th Ward. Home stability, which has been written into both the Assembly and the Senate's budget. Cuomo is pretty much the only thing standing in the way of it passing. So there's my 2 cents in the legislation that we need passed.
All right, Ellie. Thank you. Joe, what do you think?
Yeah, we're huge supporters of the Tenants Union and the Homeless Union and their platform, and we support them every step of the way. I completely agree with everything Ellie just said. And hi, Ellie.
Yeah, and Mary Lupien will actually be one of the facilitators in the afternoon at the conference, representing the tenant union and how people can support that effort.
Okay. Before I grab another phone call, Miriam Zinter, who is a mortgage officer at the Community Preservation Corporation, you mentioned home leasing. You know, we've had Brett and the team on here a number of times, and they have a reputation for more of sort of walking the walk here. Do you think developers, generally speaking, do we live in a society and in sort of an economic system where it's just not going to be common for developers to take that viewpoint? Or is it an educational sort of discussion that even within this system, we can kind of enforce values collectively that sort of demands that?
I think everything's education. I think that, you know, people believe things that they believe because they've always believed them and haven't been exposed to new ideas or new ways of thinking. I believe that most people are basically good and want to do the right thing. And if you talk to different developers about reaching out to the community, how to look at a development in more than just one way, how sometimes you can make your project more successful because you'll have tenants that pay their rent on time and completely and take care of their building, even if they are paying $100 less a month than what you originally thought you needed to get. I think that those are very good conversations that we can have with developers across the board. And I think it's very important for people to go to events like Calvin is hosting and CPC is sponsoring on gentrification. The city of Rochester hosts an event for small developers to talk about grant programs that they have access to through New York State if they keep their rents affordable and rent to people that are at 80% of median family income. So there are resources, there are ways for people to get educated, there's money available to do the right thing. Doing the right thing benefits us all as a community.
You want to add to that, Joe?
Yeah, if I could just follow up on that. I think a big thing, too, talking about, we haven't talked a lot about the area median income and this idea of 80% AMI, but I know in the housing advocacy community and for those who need affordable housing, there's a big debate around this idea of the area median income, and a lot of people want to see us use the city's AMI rather than the greater metropolitan area AMI. But what really gets to the heart of it is we want to get that kind of extremely low. So we'd be talking about the 50% mm-hmm. and the 30% AMI. And, you know, one of the things we hear from developers that are doing these affordable housing developments is that the programs, the funding that they get from the programs is not enough to make the projects pencil out if they include more units at 30% and 50% AMI. And if that's really true, and I'd love to see the actual number sheets on that, but if that's actually true, we need to know about that, and we need them to join with us and advocate it at the state and the federal level to change those programs so that we can get more of those units, because that's where the desperate need is in Rochester, is to get units for people making below 50% of the area median income. This 80% of the area median income, you're doing pretty good for yourself if you're making 80% AMI and you're living in the city.
Drew writes to us and says, Evan, can you tell your guests, be blunt with me. I live in the suburbs. I'm firmly middle class. My wife and I were thinking about buying a house in the South Wedge. Your guests have brought up the South Wedge this hour. We are white. Should we not do that?
I wouldn't say they shouldn't do that at all. I mean, the South Wedge is, you know, that's what people think of a lot of times when they're thinking of the gentrifying neighborhood in Rochester. And it's, for me, it's a good lesson on what went well and what could be done better as other neighborhoods see development, right? So now it would be very difficult to go into the South Wedge and buy up a bunch of properties and secure its permanent affordability, because it's just so much more expensive than it would be to do it right now in Beechwood, right? So that's what I was talking about earlier.
But apply Drew's question to Beechwood. Should he not move to Beechwood?
No, I think that people shouldn't not move to an area, but I think that if they do move to an area, they should be cognizant of these issues.
Yes.
And they should be working to be sensitive to it, and they should say, okay, well, how can I help my neighbors, and to be part of the solution, right? So you got to realize that what you're doing affects other people.
Okay.
Yeah, communities are organisms, so I think that it's important when you move into a neighborhood or are looking to develop in a neighborhood that you understand the history of it, that you want to meet your neighbors, that you want to understand the culture, the how the streets developed, mm-hmm. and the history of the neighborhood. So I think we're not saying that people can't move to where they want to move, but I think that we can't just exist in these sort of individual microcosms, which is very American, where it's like I go into my house, it's my fortress, I don't know my neighbors, I don't interact mm-hmm. with them. We want to sort of talk about it from that cultural lens as well. If you move into a neighborhood that has a high population of Latinx individuals, then you should understand that culture and that history of that, and not go in saying, well, I don't like the way it smells or something like that, which people do, which just happens. And so I think it's like, as Joe mentioned, being cognizant and not just making it about yourself.
Okay, move Mary. To the neighborhood. Walk around, meet your neighbors, yes. have a barbecue, whether it's in your backyard or front yard. People are people. You know, if you're good and kind, mm-hmm. your neighbors are going to be good and kind. And welcome. Welcome to the neighborhood.
Absolutely.
Okay, so the event, Spring 2019 Gentrification Conference, is 9 days away. That's 2 Saturdays from now, March 30th, 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. at the MCC downtown campus. And you can still register, and they'd ask you to do that in advance online, 540gentrificationrock.org, 540gentrificationrock.org. Not only a keynote address by P.E. Moskowitz, who wrote a book about gentrification that has been widely reviewed and praised, but also, as Calvin Eaton mentioned, workshops and a lot of different ideas on how gentrification happens and how it impacts people and what can be done about it. So thanks for taking the time. Now you know what's going on there, but I know we'll talk about this many more times as we go. Kerry and Victory, you're right. This is not just a one-off conversation.
Yes, thank you, Evan.
Thank you, Calvin. And Calvin, again, if you can't go to the conference, there's a lot going on with 540 West Main. One more time, your website online?
540westmain.org.
Nice having you back
here.
Thank you very much. Miriam Zinter from the Community Preservation Corporation. Thank you, Miriam.
Thank you, Evan.
Nice having you. And Joe DiFiore, Board President of City Roots Community Land Trust, Board Member with the Beechwood Neighborhood Coalition, and neighbor. Thank you, Joe.
Thank you.
Thanks for being here. Our thanks to Rob Braden, engineer, and Megan Mack, producer. I will talk to you tomorrow on Member Supported Public Radio.